The Ensemble podcast is intended for professional financial advisors. All discussion is limited to publicly available information and should not be interpreted as legal, professional, or financial advice. Ensemble does not hold an AFS license nor provide any financial services. Before making investment decisions, you should obtain financial advice from a qualified financial advisor.
Hi everyone, it's Neil Rogan here from Russell, and today I'm joined with a very good friend of mine, Dan Miles, the Managing Director of Enova. Dan, how are you today?
I'm good, thanks Neil. I'm looking forward to a good chat and great to catch up.
Yeah, well Dan, certainly 2025 was a very interesting year, and the theme of the year I think was the Magnificent Seven. What if I wasn't invested in the Magnificent Seven, like many investors may not have been? Were there opportunities in other markets?
Yeah, there were. In fact, I think that's probably the prevailing theme we're talking about in reviews with clients, that just following the headlines, you'd have assumed you'd had to be in the Magnificent Seven or something to do with the AI trade. There was talk of AI bubble and what that meant. We had a thesis long before, well, a couple of years before that, that the economy would be fine, and regions and sectors that are pro-cyclical, so linked to the economy's wares, should be fine because they weren't priced expensively. And whilst it didn't make headlines, you could have been allocated to a bunch of areas that did better as an Aussie investor than having your money in the NASDAQ or the S&P 500 or the MSCI world. But they just didn't make the news. But at the end of the day, if your investments are humming along and not making news headlines but are getting you the results that you expected, who cares? I hope you dive into headlines and get results at the end of the day.
So would I. Have you got an example of one of those?
So at the start of 2025, there's a big standout one, which was at the start of 2025, South Korea was just an incredibly cheap valuations. They have a passive link through to the AI thing by the semiconductor component of their market and their heavy allocation, or their heavy reliance on that. And as money came through and corporate earnings were upgraded and international flows moved in, it did incredibly well. But you didn't need to just be in South Korea, because at the start of the year, its valuation was dirt cheap. It's now not. So I wouldn't be allocating to it now. But even things like the FTSE 100, which you wouldn't think, I don't think of as a mainstay allocation in my portfolio long term, but it did very well. Just value stocks in general globally did well. But in particular, if you allocated to a strategy or a profile that allocated away from the US and to regional areas like, even just Europe and Japan, the Liberation Day, when the announcements hit in the first week of April, you were up for the year, not down. And that was just the start, and that trend continued. So there were plenty of other places that if everything just was normal, you could have bought at reasonable valuations without being nuts and without extrapolating out any, fantastic scenario, and they would do fine. And that's how it played out, which is great.
And how did you access? I'm interested to know how you access the South Korean market. Was it through an ETF, or were you buying? Oh, you bought it through an ETF. Okay, that's interesting.
Yes, we did.
And same with the FTSE. You bought access the FTSE through an ETF.
Yep. Oh, great. Yep. Don't need to be overly tricky or muddle it up with other allocations, etc. You can. You could have bought an emerging market ETF or index. You could have bought an Asian fund, and they would have been some South Korean exposure. You could have bought something specifically in Europe. You would have got some UK exposure, but you can also single them out. The breadth and availability of ETFs in Australia is very different to what it was 15 years ago.
Oh, yeah, very much so. So it talked about like the switch out away from the Mag 7. There was one standout, which I know has been quite popular. I mean, I just walked past the store where they sell it. But certainly gold and silver went on a tear. Is that the phrase?
Oh,
portfolio managers.
Just went parabolic.
Yeah. It went on a tear last year. Are we likely to see the same thing, or what's your view around resources for now?
It was also, if I concentrate on precious metals initially, say, I think we're probably misknown in the market as being gold bulls. We do often have gold bullion in our portfolio for certain reasons, but which I won't get into given the limited time. But just always being long precious metals is not all that sensible. We rotated into silver a while ago when the gold to silver ratio was very differentiated. And after some pretty in-depth analysis, but when silver went bananas like it did, we took some profits because at some point, like, first of all, compared to gold, it was no longer cheap in a relative sense.
Yeah.
But with gold, how do you determine what's cheap and what's expensive? It's extremely difficult to try and forecast the return for it. So are we going to go on another tear? Well, that depends on whether you want to jump on Alpha Hedge and read the, you know, the conspiracy theories of gold going to $10,000 and why, or, you know, like, as Warren Buffett said, it's not useful for anything. So I cannot predict where it's going to go from here, whether it's going to go on a tear. But surely when something has more than doubled in price in a very short period of time, you'd have to expect its future returns to be a lot less than what they were at half the price. And when that sort of scenario plays out, we're not as excited about it as some other areas, and you can find other ways to play it, like we did via we rotated out of the metal into the shares, and then the shares went on a tear. We rotated out of those into silver bullion, that went on a tear, and so we're pretty. I guess we were a bit contrarian selling out of it, but then January 30 comes along, and you see a 30% downdraft in one day, and we're no longer in it. We did not predict that. That was absolutely luck. Put my hand up right away, made us look very smart, but, you know, trying to predict the future for it is difficult. And when you've got so much momentum behind it and leverage behind the positions, these sorts of sharp reversals are unsurprising, to be perfectly honest.
Mm. Who do you think's buying it?
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked that. I have... In 20 years, I don't think there's been a gold bull run where there hasn't been a very well-regarded and respected commentator somewhere talking about central bank buying. The central bank introduced the Chinese central bank, it's the US, they just come up with a name, they're buying hand, note, and fist. But if you actually get the data out of the usage and demand for gold positioning and have a look, even in periods where central banks have massively increased the amount that they're taking on versus periods of time where they're either they're taking some on, but at the same rate as the years before, or they're divesting. It has no correlation to the price at all. It's all driven by the speculative positioning. So central bank owning or its jewelry, I mean, those things are reasonably stable. But when you have a look at the speculative positioning, so investors either being long or being short, that can swing all over the place, and that is what ends up driving the price of gold, so and other precious metals. So when you hear a commentator saying, "Oh, central bank buying, it's going to continue to drive the gold price up," they're just making up a narrative, or they're not aware, and they haven't bothered to check their facts. So I'd put a question mark next to their validity. Because you can do it yourself. You can go into the demand log, which is posted every quarter. I can't remember the name of the website. And you can have a look at where the demand is being driven. And if you look at that throughout history, which I've done and kept on top of it for a long period of time, it's all the speculative position. So it's the investors. It's investors piling into gold or selling out of it that cause the price drive. Maybe that'll change in the future, but it hasn't. That's been the main driver for the last 20, 30 years, as far back as I can get the data.
Mm-hmm. And is that the same for silver as well, or is there a use for silver?
No. Yeah, silver's got industrial usage, right? But I think that gets overplayed. So it's used in, when people talk about its use in EVs and batteries, it's also used as an antibacterial agent. It's often used in Band-Aids and things because it's antimicrobial. So there's industrial uses for silver, which make it a little bit messier, but the amount of silver that's out there and the amount of demand that's required to cause the price to move is very different, because it's sometimes compared to copper, and copper is a completely different kettle of fish. Copper is used far more heavily in EV demand. Copper mines are often a subset of a gold mine that exists.
Yes.
I mean, out there in the resource-rich lands of places like our home country, and the amount of time it takes to set up a new copper mine to be able to get access to copper to meet demand is a very different kettle of fish, because the amount of demand for copper from various different industrial uses, whereas silver is a bit more limited. We kind of look at precious metals. Silver's a bit different, but let's say gold, we look at gold like a currency, not just a resource stock.
Okay.
It's like an alternative currency. So if we look at it through that lens, it's a bit different, because you don't have an industrial demand dynamic in the amount that's being produced. And silver's kind of in the middle, but silver can reach points where it's been the forgotten child and people don't bother looking at it. And then out of the blue, all of a sudden, the investment market goes, hang on a second, this thing hasn't gone up anything like gold or gold miners have. Why not? And it almost always has this big parabolic run up to catch up to gold. And often gold actually comes off and silver kind of tracks sideways. And so it's gold losing money and silver not losing as much or not losing any, that kind of closes the gap in that relative valuation between the two.
Would you say that is silver then a rare earth?
No, it's not classified as a rare earth, but you'd probably be better off with my co-founder, Dinya. He could get into the components of what is actually required for something to be a rare earth, because they're not rare. It's the industrial use and majority of that conversion into a form that can be used in electronics that's largely dominated by China. I don't know where the definition of rare earths came from. I'm sure Dean, you could tell me.
So in terms of 2026, where do you see the opportunity? In the last 2 minutes, where's our opportunity?
I think it's the same sort of base case as 2025, but you don't have as many things sticking out as really, really really attractive, like South Korea did at the start of 2025. Everything is kind of a bit more either expensive, like the MSCI world and the US are still expensive, driven by the Mag 7, which means that the upside is kind of capped, because they've already got their earnings growth factored into the price, and hopefully there won't be any bad news that causes a drawdown. But areas, regions and sectors that are exposed to the economy under the assumption that a recession is unlikely and that another inflation spike like 2022 is unlikely, you're paying fair value for those things. And so a more poor position allocated and diversified sensibly in your global equity space should do just fine in 2026, assuming meteors come out of nowhere and we get an event that was unforeseen. So I think 2026 is more of a muddle through scenario where the economy figures it out. The inflation is almost impossible to predict, but assuming there's no inflation shocks, things should be okay. You should earn the underlying growth in earnings and dividends from the businesses that you're allocated to, which is what you should get from equities long term anyway, as long as you don't overpay or you can't pick them up super cheap.
Well, thank you, Dan. I know we could talk about a whole heap of things. We've got a lot of catching up to do.
Schemes, the evolving entire landscape.
It's been great talking to you this morning, and thank you for your time, and look forward to having either you and or Dinya on again very soon.
Thanks for having me, Neil. Really appreciate and enjoyed the chat.